Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Richard Martin from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, and may I of course take this opportunity to wish you all a very happy and successful new year. The new year might be the happiest moment of the year, judging by the economic trends, which, as you know, had employment at a new, unemployment rather, at a new multi-year high for the month of December, which was somewhat surprising given the extra employment that is usually used for the Christmas sales period. Anyway, as you will know, I have been away for a few days. My wife and I went to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil for the new year. I tried to combine some pleasure with a business trip. The interesting part about the trip from your perspective is the absolute and total denial in which Brazilians see their situation today. Very simply, the Brazilians are an exporting country of commodities, most notably coffee, sugar, soybeans, and other agricultural commodities, and in recent years they have been exporting in droves to China. And as we all know, the Chinese have been importing, basis their newfound wealth, from their own exports to the United States and other countries. And of course, when that all dries up, as it will do imminently, if it hasn't already started to do so, the Chinese will be less in a position to sell their products to the United States, and then therefore, consequently, to purchase commodities from Brazil. Now, this is a very simple chain reaction, and it should not be beyond the ken of the Brazilians to get this, but they do not. And in the business meetings which I had, it became almost embarrassing for me to have to explain the facts of life, given the Pollyanna-ish sentiment in which they all find themselves over there. So don't feel that Americans are alone in their lack of, or should I say their indulgence in total denial, because Brazilian is right up there with them. Okay, again, I am Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. The phone number that you can get me on my private line, if you wish to talk to me individually, is 305-357-5575. Let me repeat that. 305-357-5575. Now, many of you like to contact me by email, in which case you should do so by writing to the following email address. And it's all lowercase, please. R. Martin, stands for Richard Martin, R. Martin at gscorporation.com. Okay, the G and the S stand for Global Strategic, which is the name of the company where I work, Global Strategic Investments. Okay. And please remember to write the word corporation out in full. As I said before, all lowercase, please. I will repeat the email address right now. rmartin@gscorporation.com. And finally, the most interesting aspect of your contacts with us will be the toll-free number that gets you into the studio with which you can ask your questions, air your complaints and your grievances, and make your comments. The toll-free number is 888-873-4643. Please call that number. You will be greeted by our engineer, Eric, who will ask you to hold until such time as I find a break in the proceedings, in which case I will then ask you to ask your question, and I am informed on the computer here, so I will know at any given moment who's online. Okay, the toll-free number once more is 888-873-4643. All right, just one piece of housekeeping, please. A change of airtime for me starting on February the 4th. We will have our hourly segments on Mondays and Thursdays instead of Tuesdays and Fridays. Mondays and Thursdays, and a further change of time as follows. On Monday, I will be starting my talk at 1 p.m. and on Thursday at 2 p.m. So on Monday from 1 to 2 and on Thursday from 2 to 3, starting on February 4th. This is because Gary wants an extra hour to give a two-hour session on Fridays, and so we are moving around accordingly to enable that to happen. All right, well now, what shall we talk about today? Ron Paul comes to mind as interesting subject of discussion. And now I tell you, I've always said that I will not get involved in politics. I will not give you political discussions. If you want to know my views on abortion or immigration or any of these social values or gay marriage, you will have to go elsewhere for your fix of information from me, because you won't find it on Progressive Radio Network. However, what you will find in spades and abundance is my views on the economy and, of course, what can be done to assist the economy in its endeavors to put itself right, which will not be something that will happen in the near future, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, as you already know. And the reason that I mention Ron Paul is because he, as I have said many times in the past, is the only presidential candidate who has the slightest idea of the fact that there is even a problem, let alone what the solution is. These other people refuse to discuss it. I'll come on to that very soon. But Ron Paul, quite frankly, is a man who has done extensive studies of the economy. He really knows what he's talking about, and he has shown that he fully understands the predicament in which this country and indeed the world finds itself. And because of this, he has proposed a number of solutions, which I will mention to you, but which irritate the establishment immensely, because it is a direct threat to the status quo and therefore to their preeminence. So therefore, he was excluded, having made a 10% showing in the Iowa primary, which was way ahead of Rudy Giuliani, who had a 4% showing. He was then promptly excluded by Fox from their pre-New Hampshire debate on their program. And so very nicely, I thought, Jay Leno felt very indignant about this and invited him onto The Tonight Show, where he was last night. And he probably got a much greater exposure on The Tonight Show than he would have if he'd been included in the Fox debate. So hat off to Jay Leno there. I was very pleased to see that. And I think, in fine American tradition, Ron Paul is the underdog who, frankly, deserves better. You know, the whole establishment is actually becoming terrorized by Ron Paul's campaign. And there's ample evidence that they've employed every strategy possible to derail him. Initially, they pretended that he wasn't there. And then, you know, if he isn't there, they reasoned, maybe he'll go away. Well, next, when that didn't work, they decided to marginalize him. You know, in the earlier debates, when he was making a point, the cameras would scan the faces of the sorry crop of contenders as they smirked and rolled their eyes and did everything but stick out their tongues and to show disdain. That didn't faze Ron Paul. So then they initiated frontal attacks to pound him down. You know, Giuliani did it in South Carolina, and Huckabee tried it at a later debate. Not only did every single one of these strategies fail, the Ron Paul campaign has seemed to feed on and grow with each failure. And frankly, it's interesting, there's a TV reporter in San Francisco who analyzed it as follows, and I quote, he said, "In the war against Ron Paul, the establishment has five areas in which to attack him. One, the debates. Well, attacking him there hasn't worked out too well and is fraught with risk. When someone hits Ron Paul, the moderators are compelled to allow him to respond. And of course, this is where Dr. Paul shines. Two, the print media. Ron Paul is well received by local newspapers when he hits town, and since nobody pays attention to the national opinion mags these days, any hit pieces from them are futile. Three, the internet. Ron Paul wins every skirmish on the net. His dazzling array of supporters make sure of that. Four, TV. As with the hometown newspapers, Ron does very well with local TV coverage. It is only through the national networks and cable that Ron's enemies can effectively try to destroy his remarkable run. And finally, five, the Republican apparatus. In most instances, a single word from an upper-level party functionary can stop a candidate in his tracks. Ron Paul has never been part of their club, and this and thus is immune to their dictates. Well, the reason that I mention all this, ladies and gentlemen, is really not really so much for Ron Paul, although I wish him every success. It is because what you see from Ron Paul, and which is so very overt, although I'm sure the censors would wish that it were not, but what you see there is reflected in every area of the economy where I have been talking to you and basically telling you that you're being lied to, that information is being withheld from you, that false statistics are being presented for your enjoyment. I mean, basically, everything that comes your way in this era of a declining economy and an imminent recession is designed to make you feel good, to give the politicians a boost, and frankly, to make sure that you are happily engaged in your pursuits and not criticizing anybody for having run down an economy which is clearly on the skids. You know, so far, none of the debates are focusing on solutions for the growing squeeze. It's easier to denounce immigrants or even corporations in the abstract. The business press is now debating when the recession will hit or whether or not we're already in one. The optimism one sensed on the night Barack's last name was spelt B-A-M in the headlines is slowly giving way to trepidation that any new administration will have to revive an economy that may, before November, be on the ropes. Well, there is a reason that American Dialect magazine chose subprime as 2007's Word of the Year. Bear in mind that for the first 7 months last year, the problem was downplayed, ignored, and minimized. It was only when the markets melted down in late July that the press and polls took note. Even then, there was a denial, and in our media and political discourse, there is still among those who have yet to feel the sting. There may be a reason for that, too, because most of the progressive world has been more engaged with the war than issues of economic justice. So there has been little activist pressure on most politicians. Except for a speech here or a policy paper, economic issues are not on the top of their lists. Bear in mind also that main industries still funding the political races are, surprise, surprise, real estate, finance, and insurance. So even as the media reports on inflation and foreclosures, they often do so, as the International Herald Tribune put it, quote, with a bad news is good news scenario. The paper quotes a Bear Stearns executive with comparing the current U.S. housing crisis to a recent natural disaster. The naive silver lining thinking is riddled with illusions. Avinash Persaud, chairman of Capital Intelligence, an advisory investment firm in London, calls the housing bust a catastrophe. Quote, American consumer boom was financed with real estate debt. Americans have spent 130% of their income over the past 5 years. They borrowed money against their property. Well, now as many as 2.6 million families are facing foreclosure. That's gone. So hopefully you get the picture a little bit about why Ron Paul's message is so very inconvenient. And this is serious stuff. I mean, this is not just a few news services not wanting to produce bad news because it affects their ratings. This is people's livelihoods on the line here. And the whole establishment is determined that Ron Paul's message shall not get through. By the way, if you want to see his interview on Jay Leno, you can do so by going to the internet, and I think if you just Google his name, all his latest interviews will come up, and you can choose the ones that you want. But the Leno one was really very good. Just a quick word, by the way, on Ron Paul and what he stands for, economically speaking, and as I said, leaving aside all the other elements of his campaign, in terms of meetups, just to give you some idea of the success that he's having on the internet, the Republican Party has had 358 meetups created. The Democrats have had 356. Huckabee has had 393. And Ron Paul has had 1,498. So you have to understand that this is a man who is getting tremendous grassroots support, and doubtless for some of his other political manifestations as well, but certainly his economic program makes total sense to me at any rate. One of the things that he wants to do, as you may know, is to abolish the IRS. And before you turn off in disgust and think that I'm a complete idiot and that Ron Paul must be something out of, you know, Cloud Cuckoo Land, let me read you the law that he proposed, and it was an amendment named the Liberty Amendment. And I thought the best way to get his point across over this would be just to read it to you. And I think it's worthwhile because it says a lot. And I quote, Mr. Speaker, America survived and prospered for 140 years without an income tax and with a federal government that generally adhered to strict constitutional functions, operating with modest excise revenues. The income tax opened the door to the era and errors of big government. I hope my colleagues will help close that door by co-sponsoring the Liberty Amendment. So basically, what he's saying is there is no moral right to tax your existence. The fact that you just exist and do a job of work should not be, in his view, subject to the state taking money from your labors as a sort of innocent worker, if you like. They can take money, perhaps, for other elements of your life in the form of excise taxes, but not just taxing what he calls taxing your existence. It's an interesting concept. I know a couple of people who will not pay their taxes and have so far gotten away with it. But anyway, let me continue with the with his speech here. He says, "Mr. Speaker, I am." This is on January the 30th, 2003, by the way. "Mr. Speaker, I am pleased to introduce the Liberty Amendment, which repeals the 16th Amendment, thus paving the way for real change in the way government collects and spends the people's hard-earned money. The Liberty Amendment also explicitly forbids the federal government from performing any action not explicitly authorized by the United States Constitution. The 16th Amendment gives the federal government a direct claim on the lives of American citizens by enabling Congress to levy a direct income tax on individuals. Until the passage of the 16th Amendment, the Supreme Court had consistently held that Congress had no power to impose an income tax. Income taxes are responsible for the transformation of the federal government from one of limited powers into a vast leviathan whose tentacles reach into almost every aspect of American life. Thanks to the income tax, today the federal government routinely invades our privacy and penalizes our every endeavor. The founding fathers realized that the power to tax is the power to destroy, which is why they did not give the federal government the power to impose an income tax. Needless to say, the founders would be horrified to know that Americans today give more than a third of their income to the federal government. Income taxes not only diminish liberty, they retard economic growth by discouraging work and production. Our current tax system also forces Americans to waste valuable time and money on complacence with an ever more complex tax code. The increased interest in flat tax and national sales tax proposals, as well as the increasing number of small businesses that questioning the Internal Revenue Service's withholding system, provides further proof that America is tired of the labyrinthine tax code. Americans are also increasingly fed up with an IRS that continues to ride roughshod over their civil liberties despite recent pro-taxpayer reforms. Mr. Speaker, America survived and prospered for 140 years without an income tax and with a federal government that generally adhered to strict constitutional functions, operating with modest excise revenues. The income tax opened the door to the era of big government. I hope my colleagues will help close that door by co-sponsoring the Liberty Amendment." Well, I'm sure you all know how far that got. Another thing that Ron Paul wants to do is to end the Federal Reserve. Now, I've talked about the Fed at very great detail, at great length, in previous discussions, so I'm actually not going to discuss this here. Suffice it to say that there have been two central banks before the Federal Reserve since independence, and both of them were disbanded in disgrace because of their failed policies. So it would not be a surprise, and there would certainly be plenty of prior examples of these things happening were the Fed to be abolished today. Please note also that between the second and the third central bank, the third, of course, being the Fed, there were 70 years during which there was no inflation in the United States. However, inflation started from the very day the Fed was reinstituted back in December of 1913. You know, one of the reasons the Fed was created was to manage the economy and prevent future depressions. Well, the biggest inflation in history, combined with the greatest depression, happened 17 years later than the creation of the Fed. Please excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, just coming to the end of a nasty cold here. Another thing that Ron Paul wants to do is obviously to restrain and reduce government spending, which presumably is a Republican tenet, which has been avoided and lost by future generations of Republicans. Nobody talks about that on the Republican roster of candidates. It's a mystery how the Republican values just seem to dissolve into this kind of free-for-all, self-indulgent government for everybody that has come since the Reagan eras. But, you know, in financial terms, this has been a disaster. Another of Ron Paul's premises is that this country can only exist properly with sound money. And sound money means discipline. It means cutting down spending. It means allowing small business to grow. And basically, all the things he wants to do are spot on. They're the right decisions for a country in grave economic distress, such as this one is. But none of the other candidates, even as I say, even accept that there is a problem, let alone how they might want to deal with it. Anyway, that's all I want to say about Ron Paul. As I said, if you want to know where your nearest meetup group is, go to the meetup site, which I think is www.meetup.com, and find out where you can get some information. On the Fed, I've talked, as I said, a lot about the Fed. So, and by the way, before I do that, let me give you my number once again, where you can call into the show and we can have a little chat here right now. And it is 888-873-4643. Again, the number 888-873-4643. I wanted to talk about an article that I actually sent out to my email distribution list a few weeks ago. And it was called Crisis May Make 1929 Look Like a Walk in the Park. And it was written by Ambrose Evans Pritchard for one of Britain's most prestigious newspapers, the Daily Telegraph. And it was notable because Pritchard is one of the first writers that I know of who has considerable credibility to state that, in fact, the coming depression will be a lot worse than 1929 and the 30s, which is what I've always said myself, given the amount of time it's been in the making. And basically what he says that as central banks continue to splash their cash over the system, so far to little effect, Ambrose Evans Pritchard argues that things risk spiraling out of their control. $20 billion here, $20 billion there, and a lush $500 billion from the European Central Bank at giveaway rates for Christmas. Buckets of liquidity are being splashed over the North Atlantic banking system, so far with meager or fleeting effects. The problem with that is that maybe this money is being splashed into the system, but, you know, as I've said many times, the Fed, even if the Fed gives out great amounts of money, it really behoves the banks to spend it by lending it out to their clients. And if the banks foresee that their clients are not good for the loans, being the commercial institutions that they are, they're not going to make the loans in the first place, so the money is just going to sort of lie idle. It's interestingly enough, we've been hearing about how Bush is preparing some kind of a bailout, an economic bailout, which will be unveiled on January the 28th. Although, quite frankly, if they need a bailout, I don't see why they shouldn't get it now. Why they have to wait until the end of January is beyond me, but that's the way it seems to fall here. It's interesting that there's an obscure paper by Fed staffers David Small and Jim Clouse, which explores what can be done under the Federal Reserve Act when all else fails. In other words, if things get so bad, if you get these huge bankruptcies and defaults that I'm predicting, I guess Section 13, subparagraph 3 kicks in, which, and I quote, allows the Fed to take emergency action when banks become unwilling or very reluctant to provide credit. A vote by five governors can, in, quote, exigent circumstances, authorize the bank to lend money to anybody and take upon itself the credit risk. This clause has not been evoked since the slump or the depression. how do we actually know that this money has not found its way into the system? Well, there's a very easy and simple effort that one makes to track all the daily and weekly rollovers of the Fed, that's to say the repayment of the loans that have been made by the Fed, and then the making of new loans, which basically simply mirror the loans that have been paid back. So that the total quantity of Fed repos outstanding at any given time will lead you to discover that the Fed has only injected $18 billion in so-called liquidity since March. You know, it's difficult to understand why investors would get so excited about the Fed temporarily buying up a few billion in government securities when we've got a federal government itself that simultaneously and permanently issues and then constantly rolls over many, many times that amount in debt. You know, it's an escape into dreamland to believe that Fed actions have any chance at all of providing more liquidity when the federal government's deficits suck up in a matter of weeks every bit of liquidity that the Fed has provided in a year. These Fed actions are nothing but marginal tinkering around the edges of the global financial system. And, you know, what about the $500 billion from the European Central Bank that I mentioned that are being thrown out there at giveaway rates? At first, I thought maybe there was something important going on here. But contrary to the impressions that they attempt to create, neither the Fed nor the European Central Bank have injected material amounts of liquidity into the international banking system at all in recent months. You know, last week, the market shot higher on reports that the European Central Bank was injecting 348.6 billion euros into the European banking system, when in fact the truth is that the European Central Bank actually drained liquidity of last week. You know, you can track these pieces of information. It's very simple, but it really is a very powerful indication that however much these central banks would like you to spend their money, the banks won't go along with the program. And so the crisis that is really clearly building up is on its way and will shortly be with us. So I don't want you to have any illusions about this at all. I want you to be very clear that this is not going to lead to any solution at all as time goes by. Going on with Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, who writes this section 13 sub paragraph 3 that I just read, quote, allows the Fed to take emergency action when banks become unwilling or very reluctant to provide credit. A vote by 5 governors can, in exigent circumstances, authorize the bank to lend money to anybody and take upon itself the credit risk. Hackley, in 1973, interpreted the provision as indicating it seems clear that it was the intent of Congress that loans should be made only to creditworthy borrowers. In other words, the Reserve Bank should be satisfied that a loan under this authority would be repaid in due course, either by the borrower or by resort to security under the endorsement of a third party. Well, obviously, this restriction would significantly curtail the potential effectiveness of using loans to stimulate aggregate demands. So the Fed's hand is basically tied. You know, we're talking about liquidity here, not capital. You know, it's clear that liquidity is for credit-worthy borrowers only. You know, most of the ideas bandied about how to combat deflation, which is what we're clearly coming into here, are purely academic. Those ideas ignore consequences and haven't been tested in real-world applications. Right now, however, you know, I am actually more interested in what the Fed cannot do, simply because such discussion refutes widely held beliefs about what people think the Fed can do. You know, for example, here's a document from the Federal Reserve about monetary policy when the nominal short-term interest rate is zero. Quote, the Federal Reserve could also provide stimulus to aggregate demand either by purchasing U.S. agency or private sector debt or by extending loans in which such debt was used as collateral. In both types of operations, the Federal Reserve Act limits the actions of the Federal Reserve. For example, there is no express authority for the Federal Reserve to purchase corporate bonds or equities. And in making loans, the Federal Reserve seems to be restricted in taking onto its balance sheet the credit risk of private sector non-depository entities. So you see, restrictions in the Federal Reserve Act all but rule out money rains by the Federal Reserve. Now, this is very important, ladies and gentlemen, because it means that when Ben Bernanke talked about his famous helicopter drop, which meant that if there was a problem in the system, the Fed would simply sort of go out there and, in effect, rain down dollars from helicopters on people's heads so that they can pick them up, spend them, and then go back to work. It's quite obvious, quite clear, that the Fed would not take that kind of action, even if they could. The Fed is a private business. It's not going to give away free money, even if it could, just as Pizza Hut is not going to give away free pizzas to everyone for a year. I mean, it's amazing the powers that people attribute to the Fed. If you examine these closely, you will see that they are nothing but smoke and mirrors and a Ponzi scheme that blows bigger bubble after bubble after bubbles and crises after crises. The Fed has actually wrecked the economy by its serial bubble-blowing activity. But the Fed is powerless to fix it, because the only fix the Fed has is the very same Ponzi scheme of repetitive bubble-blowing that wrecked it in the first place. The only legitimate long-term fix is to abolish the Fed and let the free market cure the problem over time. You see, ladies and gentlemen, every act that is put done by the Fed could just as easily be done by the Treasury Department of the government. So this Federal Reserve Central Bank is duplication at worst and fraud at best, because what you seem to have here is a group of people who are feathering the nests of a few rich people on Wall Street and with very little concern about the needs of the everyday man in the street. And if you look at Alan Greenspan and how he dealt with the subprime crisis by encouraging people to go ahead and take out these ridiculous adjustable rate mortgage loans, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. You know, either he is incredibly stupid, which I think, by the way, he probably is, or he's just basically deliberately trying to pass wealth from the hands of the poor into the hands of the weak, knowing that the poor, by following his advice, are going to lose their houses. You know, I think it's important that, you know, you understand that all Ponzi schemes, a Ponzi scheme meaning one where more and more money is needed to feed a certain activity, otherwise the activity collapses, all Ponzi schemes eventually implode, and this Ponzi scheme of repetitive bubble blowing is imploding right now. History shows that once confidence is lost in the Ponzi scheme, either by lenders or borrowers, it is all over. Well, guess what? It is all over. Those expecting a helicopter drop of capital from the Fed to fix this mess will be sadly mistaken. So there you have it. More on the Fed. There's a lot more which, of course, comes out, and I try to sort of apply the information, the new information, as it were, to the misdeeds of the Fed. But again, you know, Ron Paul is the only person that understands this and the only person that is prepared to take specific action to remedy the problem, i.e. to yet again, for the third time in the history of this country, to disband an errant central bank. There you have it. Once more, let me give you my phone number. It is 888-873-4643. If you wish to ask me a question, please feel free to call at any time. Okay. Now, I thought I would talk about, I've got a couple of things I want to discuss with you before I leave you today. And one of them is an extension of the advice that I've been giving you from way back, not to believe things that you are told cannot happen. A lot of the time, we were told before the crash of 1987 that we couldn't possibly see a crash again because the Fed was in place, they knew what to do, they knew how to manipulate the proceedings, and it wouldn't happen, and everybody would be fine. And in any case, the system was much more sophisticated, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, of course, needless to say, as you all know, the crash of 1987 happened, and it was double the percentage extent of the crash on Black Monday in 1929. So just to give you one example of the kind of nonsense that people trundle out when they're trying to make you feel that everything is okay. Before we move on to this, though, let's take Tom in New York, who has a call. Tom, hi.
Hello. Hello, Richard.
Yes, I'm here.
Question is, gold is going way up, oil is up, commodities going up. How do you protect yourself? If you're just in treasuries, won't you get hurt?
No, because actually, as we speak, there is no inflation as evidenced by the movement of the bond market. You see, long-term bonds are the ultimate arbiter of inflation, because when people feel that there is inflation, they sell their bonds in order to get higher interest rates, because as bond prices go down, the interest rate that they throw off rises. So if the investing community believes that there is inflation, obviously they're going to sell their long-term bonds, because they'll be able to pick them up again at a lower price. But you see, what's happening is that, inconveniently for those people who feel that there is inflation in the system, those bonds are not falling. They're rising. They're almost at multi-year highs right now as we speak, with interest rates going down. So my hypothesis here, Tom, is that what you're seeing in terms of these prices which are rising is a very short-term emphasis on commodities, because China is still buying, because China feels that it needs these commodities to be able to produce the goods that the rest of the world are going to want to buy. But the rest of the world is not going to want to buy for very long. And so when those prices fall, Tom, all prices are going to fall across the board, because there won't be any demand for these commodities. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you take, you know, copper or crude oil, or natural gas, or cattle. I mean, all of these things, or soybeans, which the Chinese are buying from Brazil, as I told you earlier on, all these things will soon come to a halt when it is seen that there is no demand, that the American consumer is completely tapped out, unable to continue his constant purchases with borrowed money, mostly of things he doesn't need with money he doesn't have, and therefore that will cause the implosion of the system. And when the system implodes, it will be very fast and very furious. Excuse me. And all of those people who bought commodities and sold bonds will be sorry they did, because the bond prices will collapse very, very fast. So that's really my answer to you, Tom. Stay with those treasuries, because they will protect you, and they will basically give you an opportunity to buy those bonds at much lower prices if, in fact, they should sell off in a generalized panic, which I think will affect all markets willy-nilly, regardless of reason or rhyme or reason. They'll just fall sharply, and then you can buy longer-term bonds. So that's my rationale for holding on to the treasuries, Tom. Thanks for the call. Let's move back to this question of believing things that cannot happen. I just quote from somebody, somebody who writes, for almost 30 years, and count them, for almost 30 years, people like you have predicted that our economy will collapse and the end of the consumer is nigh. Throughout all of those years, it didn't happen. No matter how many logical arguments the gloom and doom crowd has made, it hasn't happened. Well, I throw that in there as a kind of as a riposte to those people who complain that the collapse has been called for so long, And it is, in fact, true that 30 years ago there were people calling for a collapse. And they even wrote books about the coming collapse. And then they included people like Robert Prechter, who's a very well-known analyst and made some excellent calls. But we're still waiting for his current call to pan out. Other things that people said couldn't happen. At one time, economists thought that inflation and recession couldn't happen at the same time. It happened anyway, and the term coined for it was stagflation. Deflation supposedly couldn't happen in a fiat regime. Well, Japan proved otherwise. If you asked anyone in Japan if housing prices could fall for 18 straight years, they would have said, it can't happen. Well, it did happen. You know, for 30 years, people have said U.S. housing prices would never again decline on a national scale. They were wrong. It happened. You know, it is the very nature of the market that it takes the convincing of nearly everyone to believe that something cannot happen to actually cause it to happen. You know, consider housing. Everyone became convinced that housing was a one-way ticket north and that all housing was local and housing would not decline nationally. Well, this mass belief in a faulty housing premise, in spite of evidence to the contrary in Japan, is what helped form the U.S. housing top. Greater fools everywhere who came to believe that faulty theory eventually rushed in to speculate in housing, and that's what made the top. Even the rating agencies got into the act. Let's take another caller. We have John from D.C. Hi, John.
Hi, Martin. How are you? How far do you see the euro in the next 2 years?
The euro?
Yeah.
I never give projections, John, and I'll tell you why. When you are in a bubble market of any nature, the top of that market is almost impossible to identify because it takes on a life of its own towards the end, and it goes to undreamt of heights. And this could apply as much to the housing market recently as it could to the stock market back in the late 90s, to gold back in 1980. I can think of any numbers of examples. Examples where I think this will happen in the future would include indeed gold and oil and maybe even some of the foodstuffs like soybeans or wheat. And indeed, as you pointed out, the euro. So if I tell you that the euro right now is trading at 147 to the dollar, and you ask me, well, could it go to 155? And I say, well, it could. And you say, well, how about 160? And I say, well, why not? And then you say, well, what about 175 or 180 or 2 euros to the dollar? My answer is that when the euro really starts to move in a very concerted way, there's no telling where it will go before it finally falls. And so it would be foolish of me and dishonest of me to give you a figure, though a lot of people will, John. A lot of people will look you in the eye and say, I see the euro at 147. I think it's going to go to 163 at the top. And it sounds very impressive that somebody seems to think that they can predict those levels. But it's all pie in the sky, John. Nobody knows. And anybody who tells you they do is just pulling your leg. So that's about as much as I can do for you, although I do think that the euro will continue to appreciate for the foreseeable future. Yes, I do. Thank you very much for your question. You know, as amazing as it may seem now, the rating agency Fitch disclosed as recently as March 2007 that their model for rating CDOs assumed low to single-digit home price appreciation forever into the future. That was less than a year ago. They even admitted that their model would break down if home prices were flat for an extended period of time. There is actually a shocking conference call discussed in a link which I can let you have if you're interested, where Fitch described those fatally flawed assumptions with a straight face. In fact, they placed so much faith in their models, as, by the way, did Moody's and S&P, that the biggest financial speculation in his housing history then took place. And as you know, and we've discussed, Greenspan and the Fed cheered the miracle of derivatives most of the way. Such folly has already cost Citigroup and Merrill Lynch their CEOs, And as of yesterday, it looks like Bear Stearns' CEO has fallen off his perch too. Well, housing speculation is likely to cost both AmBac and MBIA, their companies as well, the other rating agencies. And of course, all of these casualties of the are casualties of the bursting of the housing bubble, you know, which until last year people denied even existed. And frankly, most of these presidential candidates would continue to deny exist as if you were to talk to them. All we heard was, it's different here. The U.S. is not Japan. You know, it's just nonsense. Housing prices rose 3 standard deviations above norm in relation to rental prices, yet excuses were made as to why it's different here this time. And now, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, most still insist that deflation can't happen here. The argument, frankly, rests on one or more of the following 3 faulty premises. 1, it's different here. 2, it's different this time. And 3, the Fed won't let deflation happen. Well, before we talk about that, let's take another call from Edward in New York. Hi, Edward.
Oh, hello. I wanted some clarification from you. Your recommendation is to sell all stocks and mutual funds, if I understand you right. But I was wondering if there's any caveat to that. What I have is conservative, highly diversified funds. I've had them for some time. I don't know if I should just sell them off bingo like that.
Well, unfortunately, you know, highly diversified or diversified as a concept has, you know, been espoused by Wall Street because they want you to think that if you are very serious, you won't put all your eggs into one basket and buy all tech stocks or all housing stocks or all utility stocks, and you'll diversify your holdings. But you know, Edward, the grim reality is that when a stock market falls, everything falls. In fact, were you to be a monkey, and were you to have a dartboard and a dart and to throw your dart at the dartboard of all U.S. stocks in a market which is falling, and you had no idea which, you know, stocks the darts hit, the reality is 95% of those darts would hit stocks which were falling. So it wouldn't matter how much diversification you had. You would just be diversifying your losses, not very clever, I would imagine, and I'm sure that a lot of people would feel the same way, Edward. So no, don't fight this. If the market is going down, there are ways in which you can make money on that down move, and they involve selling short, they involve buying short funds, they might even involve buying bonds that I was telling you about earlier on, but they most certainly do not involve buying stocks. Because even if you buy 5 stocks and one goes up and the other 4 go down, what use is that to you? Hopefully that's answered your question, Edward. Thank you very much for it. We have just a few more minutes. I have more to say about this question of predictions that don't pan out and why the mocking of visionaries is actually part of the topping process. But it'll have to wait until Friday, and I think that unless the end of the world intervenes, I'll be able to follow up on this. You know, groupthink actually sets in, and it's reinforced over the years. It doesn't happen overnight. Risk premiums always drop as the long-term trend reaches its peak, and that takes time. Memories fade. You know, how many people actually do fear another Great Depression? Does anyone even remember the last one, let alone fear it? You know, what I'll discuss next time is why this credit bubble lasted for so very long. And it's some quite interesting and fascinating features that I think you'll enjoy. So do listen back in on Friday if you can. Friday, we're still on at 1 p.m. on Tuesdays and Fridays until the end of the month. But remember that on February the 4th, this will change. We'll be in on Mondays at 1 p.m. and on Thursdays at 2 to 3. So for the time being, we have Tuesdays and Fridays at 1 p.m. until February the 4th. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been a pleasure talking to you. I missed my little talk, strange though that may seem to you. I do enjoy talking to you, and I do enjoy sharing this knowledge with you. And I look forward to your emails, your calls, and I thank you for all of those who have wished me a happy new year and given me encouragement. And I look forward to talking to you again on Friday. And so I wish you a nice week ahead. And until then, this is Richard Martin from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call saying,